Hello and welcome to this podcast summary of the joint IASB-FASB board meetings that took place between the 12th and the 14th of April 2011. Joined today by Steve Cooper, a member of the IASB, and Alan Teixeira, Director of Technical Activities at the IASB. Hello. Alan, perhaps we could begin. Yesterday there was a podcast recording by David Tweedy and Leslie Seidman. Amongst other things, they talked about the timetable for completing the remaining convergence projects. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that and some background to that podcast.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mark. You're right. Yesterday, Leslie and David talked a little bit about timetable. I think you realise over the last 3 years or so, with a lot of support from the international community, we've been focusing on 30 June 2011 as our target for trying to complete the major MOU projects, and particularly the ones that are important are leases, revenue, and financial instruments. And another project, of course, that is important as well is insurance. It's not an MOU project, but it's equally important. I guess as we entered 2011, a lot of people didn't think it was possible for us to get them all finished by the 30th of June without potentially taking shortcuts. And so there's been a lot of concern expressed outside that we might be taking shortcuts and trying to rush things out at the expense of quality. We've never wanted to sacrifice quality at all in the sake of a timetable. And really what Leslie and Dave were doing yesterday was to try and give some assurance to the community, the wider community, that we are going to make sure that quality is paramount to us. And so next week or so, we expect to release an update of our program. We'll place the program onto our website. And also we're going to be doing an update, a joint update with the FASB. I think the main messages are that 30th of June is not an absolute cutoff. We are going to be producing drafts of our what we hope to be our final documents, and we'll go out genuinely with some more outreach. We'll make them available on our website for people to have a look at, and we'll have an opportunity for us to come back and regain and make sure that the final documents are of the highest quality possible. And I think David and Leslie probably did a much fuller job in terms of explaining what we're doing with the timetable. But the actual details themselves won't be released until next week, when we've just worked through the last bits and pieces with the FASB.
Okay, thank you. So to other business that was discussed during the meeting, Steve, I think insurance was covered.
Yeah, we had a couple of sessions on insurance, which was really to discuss the discount rate issue again. We've already made decisions on the discount rate. We've talked about this in the past. It's a rate that reflects the characteristics of the liability. In the exposure draft, we presented it as a risk-free rate plus an illiquidity premium. I think we had feedback that that might be quite difficult to do. So whilst we haven't changed the objective of the discount rate, we are being more flexible about how it might be determined, and including saying that you can either do a top-down or a bottom-up type approach. Now, we decided that in a previous meeting, and subsequently it appears that people have given us feedback that perhaps they're not entirely clear what we meant by that. So the staff prepared a paper to try and really nail down better what we really meant by this approach. So the board discussed that paper, gave staff some additional ideas, I think, but essentially agreed with the way the staff had portrayed it, and was sort of happy with the additional clarification. Now, in fact, this morning, two of the staff members, Mateus Andrea and myself, did a separate podcast on the discount rate for insurance. So if people want to go through it in a bit more detail about what exactly we meant by these things and the sort of stuff that we discussed at the board table, then that podcast is also available.
Okay, thank you. One of the other big projects on the go at the moment is revenue recognition. Alan, perhaps you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Those who have been following the podcast will recall that the last time the RevRec team met, we were across in Norwalk, and we had a bit of difficulty in determining the transaction price, and particularly when there's some uncertainty about the amount of consideration involved. This was a chance for the team to come back and try to wrap that part of it up. And we did that actually in conjunction with the lease accounting team as well, because we're trying to make sure that we get these contingent or uncertain amounts similarly expressed across the projects. This is also, by the way, one of the last major sessions for the revenue recognition team. So these are the last issues, really, or substantive issues remaining in the project. So for the transaction price itself, really the objective is trying to determine the amount that of consideration which the entity would be entitled to under the contract. And, of course, they said, well, to estimate that, it's going to depend a little bit. They want the most predictive amount. So essentially that should be either the probability weighted amount or the most likely amount. And it's going to be depend a little bit about, I don't want to be too statistical in the way we express it, but sort of, you know, what the likely outcomes are. And so I think that the more of a sense that you've got a normal distribution of outcomes, then you're looking at probability weighted. Otherwise, you might fall back to the most likely outcome. The thing is that what we're really trying to do is estimate what you're likely to receive. And so you're looking at the amount, the amounts allocated to the performance obligation. Is that amount, unless it's not reasonably assured to be entitled to that amount? And the type of thing is that a customer could avoid paying an additional amount of consideration without breaching a contract, for example, by simply stopping to sell under a royalty agreement and so on. So we are trying to get, you know, as I say, the most likely amount negotiated in the contract.
One of the other major standards, of course, is leases. That affects a number of a large number of companies around the world. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about the discussions on leases.
Sure. Again, leases. Really, there were two major things that we had to look at this time. We had two blocks of discussions. One was a decision-making block, and we had a look at the definition of a lease. And essentially, a lease is a very simple contract in which the right to use a specified asset, in other words, that, you know, perhaps you're leasing a car, for example. The right to use that car or asset is conveyed for a period of time in exchange for consideration. Now, it sounds very easy to understand, and of course, when you get into complex transactions, it becomes a little bit more difficult. But essentially, we have tied down a definition that all of the board members could agree with, and you know, some of the factors they had to look at is how specific the asset has to be. You know, and we use examples such as railway carriages or freight trains, for example. When you're carting freight, does it have to be a specific type of freight vehicle, or is it one with a separate serial number, or is it the capacity that we're interested in? So we worked through all of those details, and for people who are interested in all the specifics in there, if they should follow up with ISB update, they can see what we have there. And of course, variable lease payments, which is a little bit like I've just mentioned in relation to revenue recognition. What the board's decided, and as I said, we did this end on end with the revenue recognition, is that the lessees, when they calculate the liability, they should include lease payments that meet a high threshold. They should also make sure that lease payments for which the variability lacks economic substance, okay, so that, you know, that clearly if you've set some sort of lease agreement up where you're paying a notional or no rent at all, that it's absolutely clear that you've only done that to avoid stating an amount in the contract, then they would also be included in the original recognition of the liability. And they also had a look at lease payments that depend on an index or a rate should also be included as well.
Can I just jump in there? I can't quite remember what you said, Alan, but I think the lease payments that meet a high threshold, we decided in the meeting not to reflect those in the measure of the liability.
You're probably right, you know. I think I probably left the word not out of that conversation.
I was
an
just,
easy one to do.
Yeah, I was just trying to get exactly the words that you use. But we'd originally decided to include lease payments that meet a high threshold, and we talked about reasonably assured and that. But I think the staff did some feedback, and did some outreach, and as a result of the feedback from that, concluded that that was something pretty difficult to deal with, and that the lack of economic substance and looking at that aspect of it would deal adequately with this to ensure that we got the appropriate variable lease payments in the liability.
Yeah, and the difficulty is if you go to too high a threshold, then you get a lack of consistency because people interpret it in different ways. There's too much uncertainty about those amounts, and so they're trying to get. It's very difficult. People understand the notion, but getting the words is actually quite difficult. But it is the amounts that people are most likely to have to pay, which is it ties it in with.
Yeah, we're trying to capture what are in substance fixed lease payments, yeah. Even though they are structured in form terms as variable lease payments.
Yeah.
Okay.
A little bit more leases.
Yes, carry on.
Yeah, we had education sessions as well, and this is on the classification of leases and. It's whether there should be one or two approaches for the way we deal with the lease. And if you're a lessor, for example, the question is, do I essentially retain most of the risk and rewards, for want of a better term, of a lease, and I'm just letting somebody use it for a very short time, for example? Do I keep that on my books and I basically recognise the rental income or some sort of performance obligation or something like that for people to use it, as opposed to those... Essentially, do we think of leases as being a complete transfer away from the lessor over to the lessee, the right of use? And, of course, in the exposure draft, we had both notions in there, so we're questioning whether that should carry through. I might add we had a leasing working group on Monday of this week as well, so it's been a full week, and they were very helpful in providing feedback there. And it's the same on the lessee side, in that some people perceive that there are those situations where a lease agreement essentially is almost identical or analogous to going out, borrowing money from the bank and using the money to buy the asset outright. But rather than going to a bank and buying it, you're putting the financing aspect of it into the lease agreement. And essentially those payments are paying purchase by installment with a financing charge. Whereas some other ones, you know, it may be that you lease some equipment for, let's you know, a much smaller part of its useful life. It might be it's an aircraft for 3 years when you know it's going to last for 15. And the argument is that you pay a premium on that, an extra amount, because you're not carrying the residual risk on that aircraft. The other party is going to have to take it back after 3 years, and it's up to them. They'll get the gains or the losses on it. So in essence, it's not the same as actually buying an asset outright. And should we have a slightly different accounting for that? It's not a question of whether the liability and assets should be on the balance sheet. The question is, what's the appropriate income statement recognition?
Yeah, I mean, in the exposure draft, we did have two methods of lessor accounting, and we haven't made a decision yet about whether we should retain that, what the cut should be, and what changes we should make. As Alan said, we've had some educational sessions. On the lessee side, we actually only had one method of lessee accounting, accounting for the liability, accounting for the asset in the normal way, whether it was a long-term lease, short-term lease. However, many people in the feedback that we had to the exposure draft said that the income statement presentation that you get from that may not faithfully represent really the cost to the lessee. And we have had a look at that and explored alternative ways in which that presentation might be done, and alternative ways in which we might do the split between the different profit and loss recognition for different types of leases. So the board has tentatively decided that we should go with two different types of lessee accounting, and that for the leases which are not the true financing type arrangement that Alan describes, that we should have a P&L recognition that reflects the straight line allocation that we currently have in IAS 17 for operating leases.
Yeah.
But it's an area that we do need to do more work on, and it's also tied in with lessor accounting. So that decision is very much tentative until we've come up with the full model.
And perhaps to emphasise one thing in here, is that in terms of the way you look at the balance sheet, the liability and the asset, what we're working through now is exactly what we proposed originally, and that these things would be on the balance sheet. And interestingly, if you look at the income statement, even though it might be a change from what we exposed, it actually is lining up with current practice more closely. So it's an interesting sort of way of developing, in that the biggest concern people have had is all this off-balance sheet financing, which we can address, but we're examining whether or not we can retain some of the existing, profit and loss pattern recognition.
Okay, thank you. So that just leaves financial instruments to discuss. Steve, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the hedge accounting discussions.
We covered a number of different areas on hedge accounting. The first one I need to mention is the objective of hedge accounting, and in particular whether hedge accounting is available for instruments which are measured at fair value through other comprehensive income. Now, this was something that came up quite a lot in the comment letters and in the outreach. We permit hedge accounting for an item measured at fair value with fair value changes in according to the income statement. However, under IFRS 9, certain equity assets can be measured at fair value with fair value changes in OCI with no recycling, the so-called strategic equity investments, although that term isn't used in IFRS 9. And many people said that the restriction that we had in the exposure draft to only allowing hedge accounting for things where the gains and losses affect P&L is overly restrictive. It's a perfectly valid risk management strategy to be able to hedge items in OCI. So the board debated this and by a narrow majority voted in favour of changing what we have in the exposure draft to permit hedge accounting to be applied to equity instruments which are measured at fair value through other comprehensive income. Hedge ineffectiveness could be reported in different ways. The board debated that as well. We decided that hedge ineffectiveness would be presented in OCI. I think this reflects our belief that OCI is a performance element of performance. It's part of the overall performance statement, and that it is appropriate to think of it like profit and loss, and there's no conceptual reason why we should think of it differently in terms of hedge accounting. We also then discussed whether we should extend this to other items that are reported in OCI, and in particular we have the pension remeasurements, the actuarial gains and losses. The board decided not to extend it to the pensions items. So then we went on today to look at the sub-LIBOR issue. This is another controversial area where the exposure draft had certain restrictions on what you can designate as a risk component for assets and liabilities which have interest rates which are sub-LIBOR. And a common hedging strategy is to take out a LIBOR-based hedge, swap derivative for example, and use that to hedge a sub-LIBOR interest rate. The problem that we have with that is faithfully representing the effectiveness that arises as a result of, the ineffectiveness that arises as a result of that type of hedge transaction. I think there was some confusion with the exposure. I think some people felt that we were banning the use of hedge accounting entirely in this area, but that wasn't the case. What the restriction was trying to do was to ensure that we didn't end up with a situation where you applied hedge accounting and you got effectively sort of synthetic accounting, you got no ineffectiveness, and you didn't really faithfully reflect the ineffectiveness that was there. So the restriction which we voted to continue with, the board voted unanimously to continue with that restriction, is to ensure that we do get the right amount of ineffectiveness, not to ban the hedging of these types of items. I think the staff paper on this is extremely well written and very clear on exactly why the board's position is as it is. So if somebody has a particular interest in the sub-LIBOR hedging issue, I would recommend that rather than rely on my very brief explanation, they should really go and read the board paper for this issue, which is obviously available on the website.
Okay. And another element related to financial instruments is sort of impairments. Where are we on impairment?
Well, the comment period has closed on a supplementary document that both boards put out. Deadline was 1st of April, and the staff have done a tremendous job to summarise. Obviously, it's actually much easier to summarise our comment letters, having done extensive outreach, because you get a sense of what people are going to say, and then once you start reading the letters, it's reinforcing those issues. Essentially, it's... it's a difficult subject because, as you know, what we're looking to do is to put in place an expected loss model. And the proposal in the supplementary document was to essentially do a time proportionate allocation of the over-the-life losses, but also have in there a floor so that if the history showed or that the patterns were that these losses were realised earlier rather than later, that you'd have a floor to make sure that you you weren't caught short if those losses were realised. There are very mixed feedback on this, and that there are certainly some people preferred the original ISB approach, some preferred the FASB approach, some preferred the model that was proposed for in the supplementary document, but instead of having a foreseeable future floor, they wanted us to limit that to 1 year, for example, lock it down to 12 months, because in some cases that aligns with their the requirements of in terms of regulatory information. So it's a very mixed, and I guess there are two ways to think about it. It wasn't as if everybody was against the proposal, but there certainly was no clear view as to what direction we ought to take. In fact, some people think we ought to basically have a more sensitive, I'll call it incurred loss model, but really a model that pushes things into a bad book more quickly than perhaps it does at the moment. So the staff are going away on that. I'll just give you a sense of where we're heading to, because around about the first week in May, we expect the teams to come back with some more proposals. You know, but the boards are really determined to try and at least get the fundamental agreement between the two boards by the end of June. That's a goal for us.
I mean, this is a very difficult subject, and while the supplementary document was out, we've continued to work on this issue. In fact, we had a decision-making session at this meeting on how to measure expected losses and whether to use discounted or undiscounted amounts, and we decided that we would want to use discounted amounts and that the unwind of that should be reported as an additional impairment. So we have been making decisions on issues which weren't within the supplementary document itself. And these decisions and this work will stand us in good stead whatever we end up doing in the future. But we do have to sort of sit back and have a good think about the way forward on this, because it was certainly the case that the proposals in the supplementary document were seen as too much of a compromise.
That's right.
Perhaps between the two different philosophies that were inherent in what we've done before.
And unfortunately, it's a bit of a geographical split showing as well. And I think people have, or institutions have had different regulatory regimes and environments. They're used to doing a particular way of accounting. And so we're getting a bit of a split on that too.
Can I just add one thing to what I said on hedge accounting earlier? And that is that we did have an education session on macro hedging. We have new staff on this now, and this is the first of many sessions coming up on the macro hedging issue. So I think good idea to let people know that we are working hard on this aspect of hedge accounting as well, because I know this is a key issue for many, many constituents.
That's a good point, Steve, because we're trying to make sure that before we finalise anything on the general hedging model, that we actually have a very good shape for what the portfolio hedging is going to be, because people are concerned that we're doing these in isolation, and we certainly aren't.
Okay, thank you for that pretty comprehensive wrap-up. Anything else you'd like to cover?
No, really just perhaps peeking ahead. Mm-hmm. Next week's a nice week. We have no board meetings. Nothing major, I don't think, in terms of any major outreach activities either. It's a bit of a breather, I think, for both boards. And really the next things that we'll do is you'll start to see the last week of April, 27th, 28th of April. We'll have some sessions coming in. One of those will be with the FASB. The week after that, so it's the first week in May as well, we've got some education sessions on RevRec. We've got some telcos, I think, coming in to talk about some of their accounting aspects, and some education sessions and leases. So if people want to see how these two different ways of accounting for a lessee is shaping up, they'll be in those education sessions then. And then that will head us into major joint meetings with the FASB again, back into our regular May sessions.
Well, thanks to Alan and Steve for the summary. That just leaves me to provide you with the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters and do not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The only official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which will be available on the IASB website shortly. Thank you.